of Commander Grobka, a small, dark, walk-up flat on the fourth floor of an old house with bay windows. Heavy, thick furniture so cluttered the rooms that there was hardly space to move. The meal was salt fish and potatoes, but it was well-cooked, and Byron enjoyed it. He found the Grobkas disconcertingly normal, though he was prepared to detest them. When the talk got around to Byron's experiences in Poland, the woman listened with an unhappy, motherly look.
"One never knows what to believe any more. Thank God it's over, at least. Let's there only be peace, real peace. We don't want war. The last war ruined Germany. Another war will be the absolute end of our country."
Rhoda said, "It's so awful. Nobody in the world wants war, yet here we are in this mess." Grobka said to Victor Henry,
"What do you think? Are the Allies going to discuss the Führer's very reasonable offer?"
"Do you want me to be polite, or are you asking for information?"
"Don't be polite, Henry. Not with me."
"Okay. Germany can have peace if she gets rid of Hitler and his regime. You could even hang on to a lot of your gains. That gang has got to go."
Grobka and his wife looked at each other in the candlelight.
"Then it's hopeless," he said,
playing with his empty wine glass.
"If your people won't understand one thing about Germany, we have to fight it out. You don't know what this country was like in the 1920s. I do. If the system had gone on another few years, there would have been no navy, no economy, nothing. Germany would have fallen apart. This man stood up and put Germany back on the map. You have Roosevelt. We have him. Listen, Henry. I sat in a fancy club in New York and heard people call Roosevelt an insane socialist cripple. There are millions who hate him, right? Now, I'm not a Nazi. I've never said the Führer is 1,000% right. But he's a winner, damn it all. He gets things done, like Roosevelt. And you want us to get rid of him? First of all, it isn't possible. You know what the regime is. And if it were possible, we wouldn't do it. And yet, there can be peace. It depends on one man, and he isn't our Führer."
"Who, then?"
"Your president. The British and the French are beaten right now, otherwise they'd have attacked in September. When will they ever have such a chance again? They're holding out for only one reason. They feel America's behind them. If your president says one word to them tomorrow, 'I'm not helping you against Germany,' this world war will be over before it starts, and we'll all have 100 years of prosperity. And I'll tell you one more thing. That's the only way your president can make sure Japan won't jump on your back."
It occurred to Victor Henry, not for the first time, that his meeting with Grobka on the Bremen had probably not been accidental.
"I guess we'd better get on to that reception," he said.
Lieutenant Commander Preen looked surprised and interested when Byron's turn came in the reception line of floridly uniformed attachés.
"You are young,"
he said in German, scrutinizing Byron's face and well-cut dark suit as they shook hands.
"Are you a submariner?"
"No, maybe I should be,"
Preen said with a charming grin and sudden wholehearted warmth.
"Ach, it's the only service, but you have to be tough."
Blue-uniformed sailors lined up the chairs for a lecture. Pug Henry was flabbergasted by the candor of the U-boat captain's talk. It was no revelation that Preen had gone in on the surface at slack water, in the dark of the moon, that could be surmised. But Preen had no business exhibiting the Luftwaffe's aerial photographs of the entrances and analyzing the obstacles. It was handing the British their corrective measures on a silver platter. It also disclosed technical news about German reconnaissance photography. Scary news, to be sure. This was urgent stuff for the next pouch. Byron listened as intently as his father. What fascinated him was the living detail. Preen spoke a clear, slow German. He could follow every word. He could see the northern lights shimmering in the black night, silhouetting the U-boat, reflecting in purple and green sparkles on the wet forecastle, and worrying the captain half to death. He was mentally dazzled by the automobile headlights on the shore that suddenly flashed out of the gloom and caught the captain square in the face. He saw the two dim gray battleships ahead. He heard the black chill waters of Scapa Flow lap on the U-boat hull as it slowed to fire four torpedoes. He almost shared the German's disappointment when only one hit. The most amazing and inspiring part of the tale came after that. Instead of fleeing, Preen had made a big, slow circle on the surface inside the Royal Navy's main anchorage to reload tubes, for the torpedo hit had failed to set off a general submarine alarm. It simply had not occurred to the British that there could be a U-boat inside Scapa Flow. On the Royal Oak, they had taken the hit for an internal explosion, and so, by daring all, Preen had succeeded in shooting a second salvo of four torpedoes.
"We got three hits that time," Preen said. "The rest, you know. We blew up the magazines, and the Royal Oak went down almost at once."
He did not gloat, nor did he express regret over the 900 drowned British sailors. He had put his own life in hazard. The odds had been that he, and not they, would die in the night's work, tangled in the nets, impaled on rocks, or blown to bits by a mine. So Byron thought. He had sailed out, done his duty, and come home. Here he was, a serious, clean-cut professional, alive to tell the tale. This was not Warsaw, and this was not strafing horses and children on country roads. Pug Henry and his son drove slowly home through deserted streets in the blue-lit blackout. They did not talk. Byron said as the car turned into their street, "Dad, didn't you ever consider submarines?" The father shook his head.
"They're a strange breed, those fellows. And once you're in the pig boats, you have a hell of a job ever getting out. This Preen's a lot like our own Navy submariners. Now and then I almost forgot that he was talking German."
"Well, that's what I'd have picked, I think," Byron said, "if I'd gone in." The car drew up to the house. Pug Henry leaned an elbow on the wheel and looked at his son with an acid grin in the faint glow of the dashboard.
"You don't get to sink a battleship every day."
Byron scowled and said with unusual sharpness, "Is that what you think appeals to me?"
"Look here," Pug said. "The physical on submariners is a damn rigorous one, and they put you through a rough graduate school. But if you're actually interested..."
"No thanks, Dad." The young man laughed and tolerantly shook his head at his father's persistence. Victor Henry often tried to start the topic of submarines again, but never drew another glint of interest. He spent a week with Byron touring shipyards and factories. The German attaché in the United States had asked for such a tour, so a return of the courtesy was automatic. Pug Henry enjoyed traveling with his son. Byron put up with inconvenience, he never got angry, he joked in annoying moments, and he rose to sudden emergencies. A plane overbooked, a train missed, luggage vanished, hotel reservations lost. Pug considered himself fast on his feet, but Byron, by using a certain easygoing charm, could get out of holes, track things down, and persuade desk clerks and ticket agents to exert themselves better than his father. During lunches with factory owners, plant managers, and yard superintendents, Byron could sit for 2 hours looking pleasant, without talking, and reply when spoken to with something short and apt.
"You seem to be enjoying this," Pug remarked to Byron as they drove back to the hotel in dark rain from a long, tiring visit to the Krupp Works in Essen. "It's interesting. Much more so than the cathedrals and the schlosses and the folk costumes," Byron said. "This is the Germany to worry about."
Pug nodded.
"Right. The German industrial plant is the pistol Hitler is pointing at the world's head. It bears study."
"Pretty sizable pistol," Byron said.
"Too sizable for comfort."
"How does it compare to the Allies and to ours, Dad?" A glass partition in the Krupp courtesy limousine separated them from the chauffeur, but Pug thought the man held his head at an attentive tilt.
"That's the question. We've got the biggest industrial plant in the world, no doubt of that. But Hitler isn't giving us a second thought right about now because there's no national will to use it as a pistol. Germany, with her industrial setup, can run the world, if nobody argues. The means and the will exist. Macedonia wasn't very big when Alexander conquered the world. Brazil may be 4 times as big and have 10 times the potential of Germany, but the payoff is on present capacity and will. On paper, as I keep insisting, the French and the British combined still have these people licked. But on paper, Primo Carnera had Joe Louis licked. Hitler's gone to bat because he thinks he can take them. It's the ultimate way to match industrial systems, but a bit chancy."
"Then maybe this is what war is all about nowadays," Byron said. "Industrial capacity."
"Not entirely, but it's vital."
"Well, I'm certainly learning a lot." Pug smiled. Byron was spending his hotel evenings doggedly reading Hegel, usually falling asleep in an hour or so over the open book.
"How are you coming along on that Hegel fellow?"
"It's just starting to clear up a bit. I can hardly believe it, but he seems crazier than Hitler. They taught me at Columbia that he's a great philosopher."
"Possibly he's too deep for you."
"Maybe so, but the trouble is, I think I understand him." The gray, dignified chauffeur gave Byron a hideous look as he opened the door for them at the hotel. Byron ran over in his mind what he had said and decided to be more careful about calling Hitler crazy. He didn't think the chauffeur was an offended Hegelian. A letter arrived from Aaron Jastrow in a burst of airmail from the outside, a few days after the British and French, to the great rage of the German radio, rejected the Führer's outstretched hand. Mail to the embassy was supposed to be uncensored, but nobody believed that. The letters came in sudden sackfuls 2 or 3 weeks apart. The red and green Italian airmail envelope was rubber-stamped all over, purple and black and red. Dr. Jastrow was still typing with a worn-out ribbon, perhaps even the same one. He was too absent-minded, and Byron suspected too inept, mechanically, to change a ribbon, and unless someone did it for him, he would use the same old one until the words on the page looked like spirit typing. Byron had to put the letter under a strong light to make it out. October 5th. Dear Byron, Natalie is not here. I've had one letter from her, written in London. She'll try to come back to Siena, at least for a while. I'm selfishly glad of that, for I'm very much tied down without her. Now, about yourself. I can't encourage you to come back. I didn't discourage Natalie because I frankly need her. In her fashion, she feels a responsibility for her bumbling uncle, which is a matter of blood ties, and very sweet and comforting. You have no such responsibility. If you came here and I suddenly decided to leave, or were forced to go, and I must live with that possibility, think of all the useless motion and expense you'd have put yourself to.
I would really like having you here, but I must husband my resources, so I couldn't pay for your trip from Berlin. Of course, if you happen to come to Italy, though I can't think why you should, I would always be glad to see you and talk to you. Meantime, I must thank you for your inquiry. Just possibly it had some teeny connection with the other inquiry about Natalie's whereabouts, but I'm grateful for it anyway. I must recommend that for your own sake you forget about Siena, Constantine, and the Jastrows. Thank you for all you did for my niece. I gather from her letter, not from your far too modest and bare note, that you saved her from danger. Perhaps from death. How glad I am that you went. My warmest regards to your parents. I briefly talked with your father on the telephone. He sounded like a splendid man. Faithfully yours, Aaron Jastrow. When Byron got home that evening, he took one look at his father, sitting in a lounge chair on the porch facing the garden, and backed away. Pug's head was thrust forward and down, over a highball glass clenched in two hands. Byron went to his room and plugged at Hegel and his baffling world spirit until dinner time. Rhoda endured Victor Henry's glowering silence at the table until the dessert came. "All right, Pug," she said, digging into her ice cream. "What's it all about?" Pug gave her a heavy-lidded look.
"Didn't you read the letter?"
Byron thought his mother's reaction was exceedingly peculiar. Her face stiffened, her eyes widened, her back straightened.
"Letter? What letter? From whom?"
"Get the letter on my dressing table for your mother, please," Pug said to Byron.
"Well, goodness me,"
Rhoda gasped as she saw Byron trampling down the stairs with a pink envelope.
"It's only from Madeline."
"Who did you think it was from?"
"Well, good Lord, how was I to know? The Gestapo or somebody from your manor? Honestly, Pug."
She scanned the letter.
"So what's wrong with this? That's quite a raise, $20 a week."
"Read the last page."
"I am."
"Well, I see what you mean."
19 years old, Pug said. "An apartment of her own in New York. And I was the fusspot about letting her leave school."
"Pug, I merely said when you got here that the thing was done. She couldn't have enrolled any more."
"She damn well could have tried."
"Anyway, Madeline will be all right. She's a good girl. She's as straight-laced as you."
"It's this war," Pug said. "The world's coming apart at the seams by the day. What can that girl do that's worth $55 a week? That's what a senior-grade lieutenant makes, after 10 years in the service. It's absurd."
Rhoda said, "You've always babied Madeline. I think she's showed you up, and that's what really annoys you."
"I wish I were back there. I'd have a damn good look around."
Rhoda drummed the fingers of both hands on the table. "Do you want me to go home and be with her?"
"That would cost a fortune. It's one thing when you travel on government allowance, but—"
Pug turned to Byron.
"You'll be going back, won't you? Maybe you could find a job in New York."
"As a matter of fact, I wanted to talk about that. I got a letter, too, from Dr. Jastrow. I'm going to Siena."
"You are?"
"Yes."
"Who says so?"
"I do."
Silence.
Rhoda said, "That's something we should all discuss, isn't it, Briny?"
"Is that girl there?" Pug said.
"No."
"She's gone back to the States?"
"No, she's trying to get there from England."
"How do you propose to go?"
"Train. They're running regularly to Milan and Florence."
"And what will you use for money?"
"I have enough to get there. I've saved nearly all I made."
"And you'll do what? Literary research up in an Italian mountain town with a war on?"
If I get called to active duty, I'll go.
Oh, that's damn big-hearted. Seeing that if you didn't, the Navy would track you down and put you in the brig for a few years. Well, I'm proud of you, Briny. Do as you please.
Victor Henry coughed, rolled up his napkin, and left the table. Byron sat with his head thrust down and forward, his face white, the muscles in his jaw working. Rhoda saw that talking to her son would be useless. She went upstairs to her dressing room, took out a letter she had put in a drawer beneath her underwear, read it once, then tore it into very small pieces. Chapter 17. Sitzkrieg. From World Empire Lost. The Phony War. The quiescent half-year between the fall of Warsaw and the Norway episode became known in the West as the Phony War, a phrase attributed to an American senator. We called it the Sitzkrieg, or Sitting War, a play on Blitzkrieg. On the British and French side, the name was perhaps justified. During this lull, they, in fact, did unbelievably little to improve their military posture, besides sit on their backsides and predict our collapse. Early in this strange twilight period, the Führer delivered his outstretched hand peace speech to the Reichstag. Like most of his political moves, it was cleverly conceived. Had the Allies swallowed it, we might have achieved surprise in the West with a November attack, which Hitler had ordered when Warsaw fell, and which we were feverishly planning. But by now the Western statesmen had developed a certain wariness toward our Führer, and their response was disappointing. In the event, this did not matter. A combination of bad weather and insoluble supply problems forced one postponement after another on the impatient Führer. The intent to attack France was never at issue, but the date and the strategy kept changing. In all, the attack day was postponed 29 times. Meanwhile, preparations went forward at an ever-mounting tempo. Our staff's favorite comic reading as we worked on Fall Gelb, Case Yellow, the attack on France, came to be the long, learned articles in French newspapers and military journals, proving that we were about to cave in under economic pressure. In point of fact, for the first time, our economy was really getting moving. Life in Paris, we gathered, was gayer and more relaxed than before the war. The British Prime Minister Chamberlain epitomized the Western frame of mind by stating, "Hitler has missed the bus." In this enforced half-year delay, German industrial war production began to rise, and despite the never-ending confusion and interference in the Führer's headquarters, a new and excellent strategy for the assault on France was at last hammered out. Distraction in Finland. The Sitzkrieg lull was temporarily enlivened when the Soviet Union attacked Finland. Stalin's unvarying policy after signing the Ribbentrop Pact was to seize whatever territory he could, while we were at war with the democracies, to strengthen his position for an eventual showdown with us. Hitler had already given him huge concessions in the Baltic states and in Poland, to buy a free hand against the West. But, like all Russian rulers, Tsarist or Bolshevik, Stalin had a big appetite. This was his chance to take over the Karelian Isthmus and dominate the Gulf of Finland. When his emissaries failed to get these concessions from the proud Finns by threats, Stalin set out to take them by force. The rights of Finland were, as a matter of course, to be trampled upon. But, to the world's surprise, the Russian dictator got in trouble, for the attack went badly. The vaunted Red Army covered itself with disgrace, revealing itself in Finland as an ill-equipped, ill-trained, miserably led rabble, unable to crush a small, well-drilled foe. Whether this was due to Stalin's purges of his officer force in the late 30s, or to the traditional Russian inefficiency added to the depressant effect of Bolshevism, or to the use of inferior troops, remained unclear. But from November 1939 to March 1940, Finland did bravely fight off the Slav horde. Nor did the Russians ever really defeat them militarily. In the classic manner of Russian combat, the handful of Finnish defenders was finally drowned in a rain of artillery shells and a bath of Slav blood. Thus, Stalin's goal was achieved at ruthless cost of shaping up the Leningrad front by pushing back our Finnish friends on the Karelian Isthmus. This move, it must be confessed, probably saved Leningrad in 1941. After the Finnish victory during Christmas, the classic battle of Suomussalmi, in which nearly 30,000 Russians were killed or frozen to death, at a cost of about 900 Finnish dead, it was impossible to regard the Soviet army as a competent modern adversary. Much later, Hermann Göring was to call the Finnish campaign the greatest camouflage action in history, implying that the Russians in Finland had pretended to be weak in order to mask their potential. This was just an absurd excuse for the failures of his Luftwaffe in the East. In point of fact, Stalin's Russia in 1939 was militarily feeble. What happened between that time and our final debacle on the Eastern Front at Russian hands is the subject of a later section. But their performance in Finland certainly misled us in our planning. Sitzkrieg ends. Norway. Much vociferous propaganda went on in the Western democracies about the attack on Finland and about sending the Finns military aid. In the end, they did nothing. However, the opening of the Finnish front did force Hitler to face up to a genuine threat in the north, the British plot to seize Norway. Of this, we had hard intelligence. Unlike many of the plots and conspiracies of which our German armed forces were accused at the Nuremberg trials, this British plot certainly existed. Winston Churchill openly describes it in his memoirs. He acknowledges that the British invasion was laid on for a date ahead of ours, and then put off, so that we beat the British into Norway by the merest luck, by a matter of days. The Russo-Finnish War made the problem of Norway acute, because England and France could use aid to Finland as a perfect pretext for landing in Norway and driving across Scandinavia. This would have been disastrous for us. The North Sea, bracketed by British bases on both sides, would have been closed to our U-boats, choking off our main thrust at sea. Even more important, the winter route for ships bringing us Swedish iron ore lay along the Norwegian coast. Deprived of that iron ore, we could not have gone on fighting for long. When the High Command convinced Hitler of these risks, he issued the order for Weser exercise, the occupation of Norway, and postponed Case Yellow once again. It is a sad commentary that Admiral Raeder at the Nuremberg trials was convicted of a plot to occupy neutral Norway, when the British who sat in judgment had plotted the same thing themselves. Such paradoxes have enabled me to bear with honor my own experience at Nuremberg, and to regard it as not a disgrace at all, but rather as a political consequence of defeat. Had the war gone the other way, and had we hanged Churchill for plotting to occupy Norway, what would the world have said? Yet, what is sauce for the goose should be sauce for the gander. Our occupation of Norway,
a surprise overwater move, virtually under the guns of a highly superior British fleet, was a great success. Not, however, because of Hitler's leadership, but in spite of it. We took heavy losses at sea, especially of destroyers that we sorely missed when the invasion of England was later planned. But the price was small compared to the gain. We forestalled the British, opened up a much wider coastline to counter the blockade, and secured the Swedish iron ore supply for the rest of the war. Mistakes in Norway. Hitler's amateurishness showed up badly in Norway. It cropped up again and again in every campaign, tending only to get grosser as time went on. The mark of the amateur in any field is to lose one's head when the going gets hard. What marks the professional is his competence in an emergency, and almost the whole art of the soldier is to make sound judgments in the fog of war. Hitler's propensity to lose his head took two forms: calling a panicky halt to operations when they were gathering momentum, and changing the objective in mid-campaign. Both these failings appeared in Weser exercise. I give details in my Norway operational analysis of his hysterical insistence day after day that we abandon Narvik, the real key to the position. His wild, sudden scheme to capture the port of Trondheim with the luxury liner Bremen, and so forth. Why, then, was the occupation of Scandinavia a success? Simply because General Falkenhorst, once in Norway, ignored the Führer's interference, and did a fine professional job with good troops and a sound plan. The interference from above, incidentally, was to haunt operations to the end. Adolf Hitler had used all his political shrewdness over many years to gain control of the armed forces, not stopping at strong-arm methods. There is no question that this man's lust for power was insatiable, and it is certainly regrettable that the German people did not understand his true nature until it was too late. The background of this usurpation will be sketched here, as it significantly affected the whole course of the Six-Year War. How Hitler usurped control of the army. In 1938, he and his Nazi minions did not scruple to frame grave charges of sexual misconduct against revered generals of the top command. Also, they took advantage of a few actual, unfortunate lapses of this nature. The details need not be raked over in this account. Suffice it that the Nazis managed to topple the professional leadership in a bold, underhanded coup based on such accusations. Hitler, with sudden stunning arrogance, then assumed supreme command himself, and he exacted an oath of loyalty to himself throughout the Wehrmacht, from foot soldier to general. In this act, he showed his knowledge of the German character, which is the soul of honor, and takes such an oath as binding to the death. Our staff, muted and disorganized by the disgusting revelations and pseudo-revelations about our honored leaders, offered no coherent resistance to this usurpation. So the strict independence of the German army from German politics, which for generations had kept the Wehrmacht a strong stabilizing force in the fatherland, came to an end. And the drive wheel of the world's strongest military machine was grasped by an Austrian street agitator. In itself, this was not a catastrophic turn. Hitler was far from a military ignoramus. He had had 4 years in the field as a foot soldier, and there are worse ways to learn war. He was a voracious reader of history and of military writings. His memory for technical facts was unusual. Above all, he did have the ability to get to the root of a large problem. He had almost a woman's intuition for the nub of a matter. This is a fine leadership trait in war, always providing that the politician listens to the soldiers for the execution of his ideas. The combination of a bold political adventurer, a Charles XII personality risen from the streets to weld Germany into a solid driving force, and our general staff, the world's best military leadership, might well have brought us ultimate success. But Hitler was incapable of listening to anybody. This undid him and ruined Germany. Grand strategy and incredibly petty detail were equally his preoccupations. The overruling axiom of our war effort was that Hitler gave the orders. In a brutal speech to our staff in November 1939, prompted by our efforts to discourage a premature attack on France, he warned us that he would ruthlessly crush any of us who opposed his will. Like so many of his other threats, he made this one good. By the end of the war, most of our staff had been dismissed in disgrace. Many had been shot. All of us would have been shot sooner or later had he not lost his nerve and shot himself first. Thus it happened that the strength of the great German people and the valor of the peerless German soldier became passive tools in Hitler's amateur hands. Hitler and Churchill, a comparison. Winston Churchill, in a revealing passage of his memoirs on the functioning of his chiefs of staff, expresses his envy of Hitler, who could get his decisions acted upon without submitting them to the discouragement and pulling apart of hidebound professional soldiers. In fact, this was what saved England and won the war. Churchill was exactly the kind of brilliant amateur meddler in military affairs that Hitler was. Both rose to power from the depths of political rejection. Both relied chiefly on oratory to sway the multitude. Both somehow expressed the spirit of their peoples, and so won loyalty that outlasted any number of mistakes, defeats, and disasters. Both thought in grandiose terms, knew little about economic and logistical realities, and cared less. Both were iron men in defeat. Above all, both men had overwhelming personalities that could silence rational opposition while they talked. Of this strange phenomenon, I had ample and bitter experience with Hitler. The crucial difference was that in the end, Churchill had to listen to the professionals, whereas the German people had committed itself to the fatal Führerprinzip. Had Churchill possessed the power Adolf Hitler managed to arrogate to himself, the Allied armies would have bled to death in 1944, invading the soft underbelly of the Axis, as Churchill called the fearful mountains and water obstacles of the Balkan Peninsula. There we would have slaughtered them. The Italian campaign proved that. Only on the flat plains of Normandy did the Ford production style of American warfare, using immense masses of inferior, cheaply made machinery, have a chance of working. The Balkans would have been a colossal Thermopylae, won by the defenders. It would have been a Churchill defeat compared to which Gallipoli would have been a schoolboy picnic. With a Führer's authority, Churchill would also have frittered away the Allied landing craft, always a critical supply problem, in witless attempts to recapture the Greek islands and to storm Rhodes. In 1944, he nagged Eisenhower and Roosevelt to commit these wild follies until they both stopped talking to him. Churchill was a Hitler restrained by democracy. If the German nation ever rises again, let it remember the different ends of these two men. I am not arguing for the goose gabble of parliamentarians. By conviction, I have always been a conservative monarchist. But whatever the civilian structure, let our people hereafter entrust military affairs to its trained generals, and insist that politicians keep hands off the war machine.
Translator's note.
This very jarring and distorted comparison of Hitler and Churchill omits the crucial difference, of course. By the common verdict of historians, even most German ones, Hitler was a ruthless adventurer bent on conquest and plunder, while Churchill was a great defender of human liberty, dignity, and law. It is true that Churchill tended to interfere in military matters. Politicians find that temptation hard to resist. Roon's assertion about the British plan to land in Norway is correct. His conclusions, again, are a different matter, showing how slippery the issues at Nuremberg were. England was the sole protector and hope of small neutral countries like Norway and Denmark. The purpose of a British landing would have been to defend Norway, not to occupy and dominate it. In a war, both sides may well try to take the same neutral objective for strategic reasons, which does not prove that both sides are equally guilty of aggression. That is the fallacy in Roon's argument. I would not recommend trying to persuade a German staff officer of this.
VH. Chapter 18.
Warren Henry and his fiancée, Janice, were set straight about Russia's invasion of Finland by an unexpected person, Madeline's new boyfriend, a trombone player and student of public affairs named Sewell Bozeman. Early in December, the engaged couple came to New York and visited Madeline in her new apartment. Finding the boyfriend there was a surprise. The news of her move to her own apartment had enraged Pug Henry, but had he known her reason, he would have been pleased. Madeline had come to despise the two girls with whom she had shared a flat. Both were having affairs, one with a joke writer, the other with an actor working as a bellhop. Madeline had found herself being asked to skulk around, stay out late, or remain in her room while one or another pair copulated. The walls in the shabby apartment were thin. She had no way of even pretending unawareness. She was disgusted. Both girls had good jobs, both dressed with taste, both were college graduates. Yet they behaved like sluts, as Madeline understood the word. She was a Henry, with her father's outlook. Give or take a few details of Methodist doctrine, Madeline believed in what she had learned at home and at church. Unmarried girls of good character didn't sleep with men. To her, that was almost a law of nature. Men had more leeway. She knew, for instance, that Warren had been something of a hellion before his engagement. She liked Byron better because he seemed, in this respect, more like her upright father. To Madeline, sex was a delightful matter of playing with fire, but enjoying the blaze from a safe distance, until she could leap into the hallowed white conflagration of a bridal night. She was a middle-class good girl, and not in the least ashamed of it. She thought her roommates were gross fools. As soon as Hugh Cleveland gave her a raise, she got out. "I don't know," she said, stirring a pot over a tiny stove behind a screen. "Maybe this dinner was a mistake. We all could have gone to a restaurant." She was addressing the boyfriend, Sewell Bozeman, called Bozy by the world. They had met at a party in September. Bozy was a thin, long, pale, tractable fellow with thick, straight brown hair and thoughtful brown eyes that bulged behind rimless glasses. He always dressed in brown, to brown shoes,
brown ties, and even brown shirts. He was always reading enormous brown books on economics and politics, and had a generally brown outlook on life, believing that America was a doomed society, rapidly going under. Madeline found him a piquant and intriguing novelty. At the moment he was setting her small dining table, wearing over his brown array the pink apron he had put on to peel onions for the stew. "Well, it's not too late," he said. "You can save the stew for another night, and we can take your brother and his girl to Julio's."
"No, I told Warren I was cooking the dinner. That girl's rolling in money. She wouldn't like an Italian dive. They have to rush off to the theater."
Madeline came out, patting her hot face with a handkerchief, and looked at the table.
"That's fine. Thanks, Bosie. I'm going to change."
She opened a closet door crusted with yellowing white paint and took out a dress and slip, glancing around the small room. With a three-sided bay window looking out on backyards and drying laundry, it was the whole apartment, except for the kitchenette and a tiny bath. Large pieces of blue cloth lay on the threadbare divan under yellow paper patterns.
"Darn it, that divan is such a rat's nest. Maybe I'll have time to finish cutting that dress if I hurry."
"I can finish cutting it," Bosie said.
"Nonsense, Bosie, you can't cut a dress. Don't try."
A doorbell wheezily rang.
"Well, the wine's here already. That's good."
She went to open the door. Warren and Janice walked in and surprised the tall, pop-eyed man in his pink apron, holding shears in one hand and a sleeve pattern in the other. What with the smell of the hot stew and Madeline in a house coat with a dress and a lacy slip on her arm, it was a strikingly domestic scene.
"Oh, hi! You're early! My gosh, Warren, you're tan!"
Madeline was so sure of her own rectitude that it didn't occur to her to be embarrassed.
"This is Sewell Bozeman, a friend of mine."
Bosie waved the shears feebly at them. He was embarrassed, and in his fluster he started to cut a ragged blue rayon sleeve.
Madeline said, "Bosie, will you stop cutting that dress?"
She turned to Janice.
"Imagine, he actually thinks he can do it."
"It's more than I can," Janice LaCouture said, staring incredulously at Bozeman. Bosie dropped the shears and took off his apron with a giggle. Warren said, just to say something and cover his stupefaction, "Your dinner smells great, Madeline." After completing introductions, Madeline went off into what she called her boudoir, a grimy toilet about 4 feet square.
"If you'd like to freshen up first," she said to Janice
as she opened the door, gesturing at the few cubic feet of yellow space crammed with rusty plumbing.
"It's a bit cozy in there for two."
"Oh, no, no, I'm just fine," Janice exclaimed. "Go ahead." A halting conversation ensued while Bosie donned his jacket and tie. Soon Madeline put out her head and one naked shoulder and arm.
"Bosie, I don't want that beef stew to boil over. Turn down the gas."
"Sure thing." As he went behind the screen, Janice LaCouture and Warren exchanged appalled looks.
"Do you play with the New York Philharmonic, Mr. Bozeman?" Janice raised her voice.
"No, I'm with Ziggy Frechtel's orchestra. We play the Phenomint Hour," he called back. "I'm working on getting up my own band."
He returned and sat in an armchair, or rather lay in it, with his head propped against the back and the rest of him projecting forward and down, sloping to the floor. Warren, something of a sloucher himself, regarded this spectacular slouch by the limp, long, brown, bulging-eyed trombonist with incredulity. In a way, the strangest feature was his costume. Warren had never, in his life, seen a brown tie on a brown shirt.
Madeline issued from the bathroom, smoothing her dress.
"Oh, come on, Bosie, mix some drinks," she caroled.
Bosie hauled himself erect and made drinks, talking on about the problems of assembling a band. A shy, awkward fellow, he honestly believed that the best way to put other people at their ease was to keep talking, and the one subject that usually occurred to him was himself. He disclosed that he was the son of a minister in Montana, that the local doctor had cured him of religion at 16 by feeding him the works of Ingersoll and Haeckel while treating him less successfully for thyroid trouble, and that in rebellion against his father he had taken up the trombone. Soon he was on the topic of the war, which, he explained, was nothing but an imperialist struggle for markets. This was apropos of a remark by Warren that he was a naval fighter pilot in training. Bosie proceeded to set forth the Marxist analysis of war, beginning with the labor theory of value. Madeline, meanwhile, finishing and serving up the dinner, was glad to let him entertain her company. She knew Bosie was talkative, but she found him interesting, and she thought Warren and Janice might too. They seemed oddly silent. Perhaps, she thought, they had just had a little spat. Under capitalism, Bosie pointed out, workers never were paid what they really earned. The capitalist merely gave them the lowest wages possible. Since he owned the means of production, he had them at his mercy. Profit was the difference between what the worker produced and what he got. This had to lead to war sooner or later. In each country, the capitalists piled up big surpluses because the workers weren't paid enough to buy back what they produced. The capitalists, to realize their profits, had to sell off those surpluses in other countries. This struggle for foreign markets, when it got hot enough, inevitably turned into war. That was what was happening now.
"But Hitler has no surpluses," Janice Lacouture mildly observed. An economics student, she knew these Marxist bromides, but was willing to let the boyfriend or lover, she wasn't yet sure which, of Warren's sister, run on for a while.
"Germany's a land of shortages."
"The war is a struggle for foreign markets all the same," Bosie insisted serenely, back in his deep slouch.
"How about cameras? Just at random. Germany still exports cameras."
Warren said, "As I understand you, then, the Germans invaded Poland to sell Leicas."
"Making jokes about economic laws is easy, but irrelevant," Bosie smiled.
"I'm fairly serious," Warren said. "Obviously Hitler's reason for attacking Poland was conquest and loot, as in most wars."
"Hitler is a figurehead," said Bosie comfortably. "Have you ever heard of Fritz Thyssen? He and the Krupps and a few other German capitalists put him in power. They could put someone else in tomorrow if they chose, by making a few telephone calls. Of course there's no reason why they should. He's a useful and obedient lackey in their struggle for foreign markets."
"What you're saying is the straight communist line, you know," Janice said.
"Oh, Bosie's a communist," Madeline said, emerging from behind the screen with a wooden bowl of salad.
"Dinner's ready. Will you dress the salad, Bosie?"
"Sure thing."
Bosie took the bowl to a rickety little side table and made expert motions with the oil, vinegar, and condiments.
"I'm not sure I've ever met a communist before," Warren said, peering at the long brown man.
"My gosh, you haven't?" said Madeline. "Why, the radio business swarms with them."
"That's a slight exaggeration," Bosie said, rubbing garlic on the salad bowl and filling the close, warm flat with the pungent aroma.
"Oh, come on, Bosie, who isn't a communist in our crowd?" Well, Peter isn't. I don't think Myra is. Anyway, that's just our gang, he added to Warren. It dates from the Spanish Civil War days. We put on all kinds of shows for the benefit of the Loyalists. Bosie brought the salad bowl to the table, where the others were already seated. Of course, there's just a few of us left now. A lot of the crowd dropped away after Stalin made the pact with Hitler. They had no fundamental convictions.
Didn't that pact bother you? Warren said.
Bother me? Why? It was a wise move. The capitalist powers want to snuff out socialism in the Soviet Union. If they bleed themselves white beforehand, fighting each other, the final attack on socialism will be that much weaker. Stalin's peace policy is very wise.
Warren said, Suppose Hitler polishes off England and France in a one-front war and then turns and smashes Russia. That may well happen. Stalin could have made a deal with the Allies, and all of them together would have had a far better chance of stopping the Nazis.
But don't you see, there's no reason for a socialist country to take part in an imperialist struggle for foreign markets, Bosie patiently explained to the benighted naval aviator. Socialism doesn't need foreign markets, since the worker gets all he creates.
Bosie, will you bring the stew? Madeline said.
Sure thing.
Janice LaCouture said, speaking louder as he went behind the screen,
But surely you know that a Russian worker gets less than a worker in any capitalist country.
Of course, there are two reasons for that. Socialism triumphed first in a feudal country, Bosie said, reappearing with the stew, and had a big industrial gap to close. Also, because of the imperialist threat, socialism had to divert a lot of production to arms. When socialism triumphs everywhere, arms will become useless, and they'll all be thrown in the sea.
But even if that happens, which I doubt, it seems to me, said Janice, that when the state owns the means of production, the workers will get less than if capitalists own them. You know how inefficient and tyrannical government bureaucracies are.
Yes, interjected Madeline, but as soon as socialism triumphs everywhere, the state will wither away because nobody will need a central government anymore. Then the workers will get it all. Pass the wine around, Bosie.
Sure thing.
Warren said to his sister, narrowing his eyes at her,
Do you believe that?
Well, that's how the argument goes, Madeline said, giggling.
Wouldn't Dad die if he knew I'd made friends with communists? For heaven's sake, don't write and tell him.
Have no fear. Warren turned to Bosie. What about Finland? The Russian invasion of the tiny northern country was then about a week old, and already looking like a disaster.
Okay, what about it?
Well, you know Russia claims that Finland attacked her, the way Hitler claimed Poland attacked Germany. Do you believe that?
It's ridiculous to think that Poland attacked Germany, Bosie said calmly. But it's highly likely that Finland attacked the Soviet Union. It was probably a provocation engineered by others to embroil socialism in the imperialist war.
The Soviet Union is 50 times as big as Finland, Janice LaCouture said.
I'm not saying the Finns did something wise, said Bosie. They were egged on into making a bad mistake. Anyway, Finland just used to be a duchy of Tsarist Russia. It's not an invasion, exactly. It's a rectification.
Oh, come on, Bosie,
Madeline said. Stalin's simply making hay while the sun shines, slamming his way in there to improve his strategic position against Germany.
Of course, Warren said, and that's a damned prudent move in his situation, whatever the morality of it may be.
Bosie smiled cunningly, his eyes starting from his head.
Well, it's quite true he wasn't born yesterday. The imperialists all lift up their hands in holy horror when a socialist government does something realistic. They think that's their exclusive privilege.
Why do you suppose the invasion's flopping on its face? Warren said.
Oh, do you believe the capitalist newspapers? Said Bosie, with a broad wink.
You think the Russians are really winning?
Why, all this nonsense about the Finnish ski troops and white uniforms makes me ill, Bosie said. Don't you suppose the Russians have skis and white uniforms, too? But catch the New York Times saying so.
This is a lovely stew, Janice said. I used too many cloves, Madeline said. Don't bite into one.
Warren and Janice left right after dinner to go to the theater. He was on a 72-hour pass from Pensacola, and Janice had come up from Washington to meet him. Dinner with Madeline had been a last-minute arrangement by long-distance telephone. When they left, Madeline was cutting out her dress, and Bosie was washing the dishes.
"What do I do now?" Warren said, out in the street. The theater was only a few blocks away. It was snowing, and cabs were unobtainable, so they walked.
"Get myself a shotgun?"
"What for? To put Bosie out of his misery?"
"To get him to marry her was my idea."
Janice laughed and hugged his arm.
"There's nothing doing between those two, honey."
"You don't think so?"
"Not a chance. That's quite a gal, your little sister."
"Jesus Christ, yes. The Red Flame of Manhattan. That's a hell of a note. And I wrote my folks I was going to visit her. Now what do I say?"
"You just write your parents that everything's peachy with her, because it is."
They walked with heads bent, the snow whirling on the wind into their faces.
"Why are you so quiet?" said Janice. "Don't worry about your sister. Really, you don't have to."
"I'm thinking how this war's blown our family apart. I mean, we used to scatter here and there," Warren said. "We're a service family, and we're used to that. But it's different now. I don't feel there's a base anymore. And we're all changing. I don't know if we'll ever pull back together again."
"Sooner or later, all families change and scatter," said Janice Lacouture. "And out of the pieces, new families start up. That's how it goes. And a very lovely arrangement it is, too."
She put her face to his for a moment, and snowflakes fell on the two warm cheeks.
"The imperialists struggle for foreign markets," said Warren.
"Jehoshaphat, I hope she's rid of that one by the time Dad gets back. Otherwise, he'll lay waste to Radio City."
Chapter 19
"Byron!"
Dr. Jastrow gasped out the name and stared. He sat, as usual, on the terrace, the blue blanket over his legs, the gray shawl around his shoulders, the writing board and yellow pad on his lap. A cold breeze blowing across the valley from Siena fluttered Jastrow's pages. In the translucent air, the red-walled town, with its black-and-white striped cathedral atop the vineyard-checkered hills, looked hauntingly like the medieval Siena in old frescoes.
"Hello, A.J."
"Dear me, Byron, I declare I'll be a week recovering from the start you've given me. We were talking about you only at breakfast. We were both absolutely certain you'd be in the States by now."
"She's here?"
"Of course. She's up in the library."
"Sir, will you excuse me?"
"Yes, go ahead. Let me collect myself. Oh, and Byron, tell Maria I'd like some strong tea right away."
Byron took the center hall steps,
three at a time, and walked into the library. She stood at the desk in a gray sweater, a black skirt, pale and wide-eyed.
"It is, by God, it is you. Nobody else galumps up those stairs like that."
"It's me."
"Why the devil did you come back?"
"I have to make a living."
"You're an imbecile. Why didn't you let us know you were coming?"
"Well, I thought I'd better just come." She approached him, stretched out a hand uncertainly, and put it to his face. The long fingers felt dry and cold.
"Anyway, you look rested. You seem to have put on some weight."
She backed off, awkwardly and abruptly.
"I owe you an apology. I was feeling beastly that day in Königsberg, and if I was rude to you, I'm sorry."
She walked away from him and sank into her desk chair.
"Well, we can use you here, but surprises like this are never pleasant. Don't you know that yet?"
As though he had returned from an errand in town, she resumed clattering at the typewriter. That was all his welcome. Jastrow put him back to work, and within a few days, the old routines were restored. It was as though the Polish experience had never occurred, as though neither of them had left the hilltop. The traces of the war in these quiet hills were few. Only sporadic shortages of gasoline created any difficulty. The Milan and Florence newspapers that reached them played down the war. Even on the BBC broadcasts, there was little combat news. The Russian attack on Finland seemed as remote as a Chinese earthquake. Because the buses had become unreliable, Dr. Jastrow gave Byron a lodging on the third floor of the villa. A cramped little maid's room with cracking plaster walls and a stained ceiling that leaked in hard rains. Natalie lived directly below Byron in a second-floor bedroom looking out on Siena. Her peculiar manner to him persisted. At mealtimes, and generally in Jastrow's presence, she was distantly cordial. In the library, she was almost uncivil, working away in long silences and giving terse, cool answers to questions. Byron had a modest opinion of himself and his attractions, and he took his treatment as probably his due, though he missed the comradeship of their days in Poland and wondered why she never talked about them. He thought he had probably annoyed her by following her here. He was with her again, and that was why he had come. So for all the brusque treatment, he was as content as a dog reunited with an irritable master. When Byron arrived in Siena, the Constantine book was on the shelf for the moment, in favor of an expanded magazine article, The Last Pollio. In describing the race, Jastrow had evoked a gloom-filled image of Europe plunging again toward war. A piece startling in its foresight, it had arrived on the editor's desk on the 1st of September, the day of the invasion. The magazine printed it, and Jastrow's publisher cabled him a frantic request to work it up into a short book, preferably containing a note of optimism, however slight, on the outcome of the war. The cable mentioned a large advance against royalties. This was the task in hand. In this brief book, Jastrow was striking an Olympian, far-seeing, forgiving note. The Germans would probably be beaten to the ground again, he wrote, and even if they gained the rule of the earth, they would, in the end, be tamed and subdued by their subject peoples, as their ancestors, the Goths and Vandals, had been tamed to turn Christian. Fanatic or barbaric despotism had only its hour. It was a recurring human fever fated to cool and pass. Reason and freedom were what all human history eternally moved toward. The Germans were the bad children of Europe, Jastrow argued. Egotistic, willful, romantic, always poised to break up faltering patterns of order. Arminius had set the axe to the Pax Romana. Martin Luther had broken the back of the Universal Church. Now, Hitler was challenging Europe's unsteady regime of liberal capitalism, based on an obsolete patchwork structure of nations. "The polio of Europe," wrote Jastrow, "the contest of hot little nationalisms in a tiny, crowded cockpit of a continent, a larger Siena with the sea for three walls and Asia for a fourth, was worn out. As Siena had only one water company and one power company, one telephone system and one mayor, instead of 17 of these in the 17 make-believe sovereignties called Goose, Caterpillar, Giraffe, and so forth, so Europe was ripe for the same common-sense unification. Hitler, a bad boy genius, had perceived this. He was going about the breakup of the old order cruelly, wrongly, with Teutonic fury. But what mattered was that he was essentially correct. The Second World War was the last polio. Europe would emerge less colorful, but more of a rational and solid structure, whichever side won the idiotic and gory horse race. Perhaps this painful but healthy process would become global, and the whole earth would be unified at last. As for Hitler, the villain of the melodrama, he would either be hunted down and bloodily destroyed, like Macbeth, or he would have his triumph, and then he would fall or die. The stars would remain, so would the earth, so would the human quest for freedom, understanding, and love among brothers." As he typed repeated drafts of these ideas, Byron wondered whether Jastrow would have written such a tolerant and hopeful book had he spent September under bombardment in Warsaw, instead of in his villa overlooking Siena. He thought the last polio was a lot of high-flown, irrelevant gab, but he didn't say so. Letters were coming to Natalie from Leslie Sloat, one or two a week. She seemed less excited over them than she had been in the spring, when she would rush off to her bedroom and read them, and return looking sometimes radiant, sometimes tearful. Now she casually skimmed the single-space typed pages at her desk, then shoved them in a drawer. One rainy day she was reading such a letter when Byron, typing away at the polio book, heard her say, "Good God!" He looked up. "Something the matter?" "No, no," she said, very red in the face, waving an agitated hand and flipping over a page. "Sorry, it's nothing at all." Byron resumed work, struggling with one of Jastrow's bad sentences. The professor wrote in a spiky, hurried hand, often leaving out letters or words. He seldom closed his S's and O's. It was anybody's guess what words some of these strings of blue spikes represented. Natalie could puzzle them out, but Byron disliked her pained, condescending way of doing it. "Well." Natalie sat back in her chair with a thump, staring at the letter. "Briney." "Yes." She hesitated, chewing her full lower lip. "Oh, hell, I can't help it. I've got to tell someone, and you're handy. Guess what I hold here in my hot little hand." She rustled the pages. "I see what you're holding." "You only think you do," she laughed in a wicked way. "I'm going to tell you. It's a proposal of marriage from a gentleman named Leslie Manson Sloat, Rhodes Scholar, rising diplomat, and elusive bachelor. And what do you think of that, Byron Henry?"
"Congratulations," Byron said.
The buzzer on Natalie's desk rang. "Oh, Lord, Briney, please go and see what AJ wants. I'm in a fog." She tossed the letter on the desk and thrust long white hands in her hair. Dr. Jastrow sat blanketed in the downstairs study on the chaise lounge by the fire, his usual place in rainy weather. Facing him in an armchair, A fat, pale Italian official, in a green and yellow uniform and black half-boots, was drinking coffee. Byron had never seen the man or the uniform before.
"Oh, Byron, ask Natalie for my resident status file, will you? She knows where it is."
Jastrow turned to the official.
"Will you want to see their papers, too?"
"Not today, professore, only yours."
Natalie looked up with an embarrassed grin from rereading the letter.
"Oh, hi, what's doing?"
Byron told her. Her face sobering, she took a key from her purse and unlocked a small steel file by the desk.
"Here."
She gave him a manila folder tied with red tape.
"Does it look like trouble? Shall I come down?"
"Better wait till you're asked." As he descended the stairs, he heard laughter from the study and rapid, jovial talk.
"Oh, thank you, Byron," Jastrow said, breaking into English as he entered. "Just leave it here on the table."
He resumed his anecdote in Italian about the donkey that had gotten into the grounds the previous week, laid waste to a vegetable patch, and chewed up a whole chapter of manuscript. The official's belted belly shook with laughter. In the library, Natalie was typing again. The Sloat letter was out of sight.
"There doesn't seem to be much of a problem," Byron said.
"That's good," she said placidly.
At dinner that night, Dr. Jastrow hardly spoke, ate less than usual, and drank 2 extra glasses of wine. In this household, where things were so monotonously the same day after day, night after night, the first extra glass was an event, the second a bombshell. Natalie finally said,
"Aaron, what was that visit about today?"
Jastrow came out of an abstracted stare with a little headshake. "Strangely enough, Giuseppe again." Giuseppe was the assistant gardener, whom he had recently discharged, a scrawny, lazy, stupid old drunkard with wiry black hairs on his big, knobby purple nose. Giuseppe had left open the gate through which the donkey had entered. He was always committing such misdemeanors. Jastrow had lost his temper over the destroyed chapter and the ravaged vegetable beds, had been unable to write for 2 days, and had suffered bad indigestion.
"How does that officer know Giuseppe?" Byron said.
"That's the odd part. He's from the Alien Registration Bureau in Florence, yet he mentioned Giuseppe's 9 children, the difficulty of finding work nowadays, and so forth. When I said I'd rehire him, that ended it. He just handed me the registration papers with a victorious grin."
Jastrow sighed and laid his napkin on the table.
"I've put up with Giuseppe all these years. I really don't mind. I'm rather tired. Tell Maria I'll have my fruit and cheese in the study."
Natalie said when the professor was gone, "Let's bring the coffee to my room."
"Sure, great."
Never before had she invited him there. Sometimes in his room above he could hear her moving about, a tantalizing, faint, lovely noise. He followed her upstairs with a jumping pulse. "I live in a big candy box," she said, with a self-conscious look, opening a heavy door. "Aaron bought the place furnished, you know, and left it just the way the lady of the house had it. Ridiculous for me, but..." She snapped on a light. It was an enormous room, painted pink, with pink and gilt furniture, pink-painted cupids on a blue and gold ceiling, pink silk draperies, and a huge double bed covered in frilly pink satin. Dark Natalie, in the old brown wool dress she wore on chilly evenings, looked decidedly odd in this Watteau setting. But Byron found the contrast as exciting as everything else about her. She lit the log fire in the marble fireplace, carved with Roman figures, and then sat in facing armchairs, taking coffee from the low table between them.
"Why do you suppose Aaron's so upset?"
Natalie said, settling comfortably in the large chair and pulling the long pleated skirt far down over her beautiful legs.
Giuseppe's an old story. Actually, it was a mistake to fire him. He knows all about the water connections and the electric lines much more than Tommaso. And he's really good at the topiary work, even if he is a dirty old drunk. AJ was coerced, Natalie. She bit her lip, nodding. Byron added, "We're at the mercy of these people, AJ, even more than you and me. He owns property. He's stuck here." "Oh, the Italians are all right. They're not Germans."
"Mussolini's no bargain."
Beryl gave AJ the right advice. "Get out." Natalie smiled. "Lech lecha. My God, how far off that all seems. I wonder how he is." Her smile faded. "I've shut Warsaw from my mind, or tried to."
"I don't blame you."
"How about you, Briny? Do you ever think about it?"
"Some. I keep dreaming about it."
"Oh, God, so do I. That hospital. I go round and round in it, night after night."
"When Warsaw fell," Byron said, "it hit me hard."
He told Natalie about the Wannsee episode. At his description of the waiter's sudden turnabout, she laughed bitterly.
"Your father sounds superb."
"He's all right."
"He must think I'm a vampire who all but lured you to your death. We haven't talked about you."
Sudden gloom shadowed Natalie's face. She poured more coffee for both of them. "Stir the fire, Briny. I'm cold." Giuseppe's brought in green wood as usual. He made the fire flare and threw on it a light log from a blighted tree, which quickly blazed.
"Oh, that's good."
She jumped up, turned off the electric chandelier, and stood by the fire, looking at the flames.
"That moment in the railroad station," she nervously burst out, "when they took away the Jews, I still can't face it. That was one reason I was so nasty at Königsberg. I was in torture. I kept thinking that I could have done something. Suppose I'd stepped forward, said I was Jewish, forced the issue. Suppose we'd all created a scandal. It might have made a difference. But we calmly went to the train, and they trudged off the other way."
Byron said,
"We might have lost you and Mark Hartley. The thing was touch and go."
"Yes, I know. Leslie prevented that. He stood his ground, at least, though he was shaking like a leaf. He did his plain duty. But those other ambassadors and chargés, well..."
Natalie had begun to pace.
"And my family in Medjic, when I picture those kind, good people in the clutches of the Germans. But what's the use? It's futile. It's sickening to dwell on that."
She threw up her hand in a despairing gesture and dropped in her chair, sitting on her legs with her skirt spread over them. Nothing of her was visible in the firelight but her face and her tensely clasped hands. She stared at the fire.
"Speaking of old Sloat," she said after a long pause, in an entirely different tone, "what do you think of his proposal to make an honest woman of me?"
"I'm not surprised."
"You're not? I'm stunned. I never thought I'd live to see the day."
"He told me in Berlin he might marry you. He'd be crazy not to, if he could."
"Well, he's had that option open to him for a hell of a long time, dear."
She poured coffee and sipped, looking darkly at him over the rim of the cup.
"Had a big discussion about me in Berlin, you two gentlemen, did you?"
"Not a big discussion. He mentioned that you were just as surly to him that last day in Königsberg as you'd been to me."
"I was feeling absolutely horrible that day, Briny."
"Well, that's all right. I thought I might have offended you somehow, so I asked him."
"This is getting interesting. What else did Sloat say about me?"
The low, vibrant voice, the amused glinting of her eyes in the firelight, stirred Byron.
"That you were no girl for me to get involved with, and that he hadn't known an hour's peace of mind since he first laid eyes on you."
She uttered a low, gloating laugh.
Two accurate statements, my pet. Tell me more.
That's about it. It was the same conversation in which he gave me the reading list.
Yes, and wasn't that pure Sloat, coming it over you with his book learning? An illuminating little incident, that. Didn't he really tell you all about us, about him and me?
Byron shook his head.
Natalie said, "You wouldn't go and get us some brandy, would you? I think I'd like a little brandy."
He raced down the stairs and up again, returning with a bottle and two shimmering snifters. Swirling the brandy round and round in her hands, looking into the balloon glass and rarely raising her eyes at him, Natalie broke loose with a surprising rush of words about her affair with Leslie Sloat. It took her a long time. Byron said little, interrupting only to throw more wood on the fire. It was a familiar tale of a clever older man having fun with a girl and getting snared into a real passion. Resolving to marry him, she had made his life a misery. He didn't want to marry her, she said, simply because she was Jewish, and it would be awkward for his career. That was all his clouds of words had ever come to. At last, with this letter, after 30 months, she had him where she wanted him. Byron hated every word of the story, yet he was fascinated and grateful. The closed-mouthed girl was taking him into her life. These words, which couldn't be unsaid, were ending the strange tension between them since Warsaw, their own little phony war, the long hostile silences in the library, her holding up in her room, her odd snappish condescension. As she talked, they were growing intimate as they never had become in a month of adventuring through Poland.
Everything about this girl interested him.
If it was the account of her affair with another man, let it be that. At least Byron was talking about Natalie Jastrow with Natalie Jastrow, and this was what he had been starved for. He was hearing this sweet, rough voice with its occasional New Yorkisms, and he could watch the play of her free, gesturing hand in the firelight, the swoop and sudden stop in the air of flat palm and fingers, her visible signature. Natalie Jastrow was the one person he had ever met who meant as much to him as his father did. In the same way, almost, he hungered to talk to his father, to listen to him, to be with him, even though he had to resist and withdraw, even though he knew that in almost every conversation he either offended or disappointed Victor Henry. His mother he took for granted, a warm presence, cloying in her affection, annoying in her kittenish changeability. His father was terrific, and in that way Natalie was terrific, entirely aside from being a tall, dark girl whom he had hopelessly craved to seize in his arms since the first hour they had met.
"Well, there you have it," Natalie said. "This mess has been endless, but that's the general idea. How about some more of Aaron's brandy? Wouldn't you like some? It's awfully good brandy."
"Funny, I usually don't care for it." Byron poured more for both of them, though his glass wasn't empty.
"What I've been puzzling about all day," she said after a sip, "is why Leslie is throwing in the towel now."
"The trouble is, I think I know."
"He's lonesome for you," Byron said.
Natalie shook her head.
"Leslie Sloat behaved disgustingly on the Prachau Road. I despised him for it, and I let him know I did. That was the turnaround. He's been chasing me ever since."
"I guess in a way I've been running too. I haven't even answered half his letters."
Byron said, "You've always exaggerated that whole thing. All he did—"
"Shut up, Byron. Don't be mealy-mouthed with me. All he did was turn yellow and use me as an excuse.
He hid behind my skirts. The Swedish ambassador all but laughed in his face.
She tossed off most of her brandy.
Look, physical courage isn't something you can help. It isn't even important nowadays. You can be a world leader and a cringing sneak. That's what Hitler probably is. Still, it happened. It happened. I'm not saying I won't marry Leslie Sloat because shellfire made him panic. After all, he behaved well enough at the railroad station. But I do say that's why he's proposing to me. This is his way of apologizing and being a man. It's not quite the answer to my maidenly prayers.
It's what you want.
Well, I don't know. There are complications. There's my family. My parents had wild fits when I told them I was in love with a Christian. My father took to bed for a week, though that bit of melodrama left me unmoved. Well, now there's that whole fight again, and Leslie's proposal is odd. It's not very specific as to time and place. If I wrote him back yes, he might well get on his bicycle again.
If he's really that kind of fool, which I doubt very much, Byron said, you could just let him bicycle away.
Then there's Aaron. He's not your problem. He ought to get out of Italy in any case. He's very reluctant to go.
Well, he survived while we were away.
Oh, that's what you think. You should have seen the library and study when I got back. Chaos. And he hadn't written anything in weeks. Aaron should have gotten married ages ago. He didn't, and he needs a lot of fussing and petting. He can't even sharpen a pencil properly.